The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering iPhone and iPad repairs, including liquid damage, cracked screens, failing batteries, and other issues. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, once again in the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas. Thanks so much for listening.
This is James Wright Foley, an American citizen of your country. As a government, you have been at the forefront of the aggression towards the Islamic State. You have plotted against us and gone far out of your way to find reasons to interfere in our affairs.
Today, this voice was among the last things heard by the late journalist James Foley, brutally beheaded by ISIS while in custody in Syria. His death, seen around the world, carried out by this evil ranting from the black-hooded terrorist called Jihadi John. He's identified as Mohammed Emwazi, a British-accented militant who also appeared in videos with Stephen Sotloff and Peter Kasich when they were beheaded. Reports today that he may have been killed in an airstrike.
We cannot yet be certain if the strike was successful. But let me be clear. I've always said that we would do whatever was necessary, whatever it took, to track down Emwazi and to stop him taking the lives of others.
Prime Minister David Cameron speaking today in London. The news arrives as Kurdish forces advance against ISIS in Sinjar and as American forces increase attacks on ISIS-held oil fields in northern Syria. Joining us is Eric Schmidt, national security correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. He says Jihadi John may be a symbol of the brutality of ISIS, but if he's indeed gone, it reduces the reach of ISIS to disrupt and create fear far beyond the battlefield.
Well, in many ways, he's the face of ISIS. For many, particularly English-speaking citizens around the world, he's the guy who's been in front of the videos for many of the American, British, and other Western hostages who were executed, beheaded by the Islamic State. And so I think he's come to symbolize, in many ways, the vicious brutality of the Islamic State. But they have very few people like him who came to be just seemed to, you know, the specter of death shows up once again in his black mask and all with that, as you said, a British accent, kind of taunting the West, and is, again, English-speaking terrorist who joined this group. And so I think it's important in that sense that the Allies felt, U.S. and Britain in particular, felt they needed to take him off the battlefield.
Do you think this attack represents some kind of escalation as diplomacy seems to be picking up speed and there's an initiative, an offensive going on in Sinjar and the Ramadi campaign seems to be increasing in some way, that both of these are increasing in their activity, anticipating some sort of endgame?
Well, I think what you've heard from President Obama, you heard from Secretary of State John Kerry in a speech yesterday on Syria, is that you're going to see much more of a push on all these fronts, the diplomatic front, the military front, the financial front. We have a story today talking about how the U.S. is going to be much more aggressive in going after the oil fields that produce one of the biggest sources of revenue for ISIS. So I think there was some frustration over the summer that the campaign overall wasn't having the kind of effect that it wanted on ISIS, and now at least you're seeing some efforts to ramp it up on many fronts.
Do you think that the cooperation between the U.S. and the Kurds has taken on new meaning or a new sense of camaraderie, for lack of a better word? It seems in some ways, looking at the Sinjar campaign, that we're, in some sense, wittingly or not, fighting for Kurdish independence and less a battle against ISIS, which is also going on in Ramadi as well with the Iraqi forces.
Well, certainly that's a perception the U.S. is sensitive to, particularly with its ally Turkey, which fears exactly the scenario you just painted, that the Kurds will be emboldened on all sides, whether it's in Turkey, Iraq, or Syria. This will embolden them for some type of state of their own. But the U.S. is kind of down to not very many reliable players on the ground they can work with. The Kurds have been a reliable partner dating all the way back to the first Gulf War in the early 1990s. So they knew they could rely on them in northern Iraq. What's been a little bit of surprise was how they could rely on the Syrian Kurds across the border to help clear ISIS from much of the northern, northeastern border between Syria and Turkey. So what you've now seen is not only, as you said, U.S. advisors on the ground in northern Iraq and Sinjar helping to direct airstrikes in this latest operation, And of course, the president ordering us up to 50 special operations forces to deploy to eastern Syria to help coalition of Syrian Kurds and Arabs who are pressing toward Raqqa, the self-proclaimed capital of ISIS in eastern Syria. So the Kurds are playing a very important role, largely because they've turned out to be one of the few reliable partners on the ground that can take territory.
Eric Schmidt is national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much, Eric.
You're welcome.
This next story references some alarming traffic death and injury data in America. According to the most recent statistics of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, well over 2 million people are killed or injured each year on the roads. A pedestrian is killed every 2 hours and injured every 7 minutes in traffic crashes in the United States. But this story is really about what you are willing to tolerate. 2 million dead or injured. Sad, but sounds like about the right number of accidents in our crazy, complicated world, right? Well, our next two guests reject the idea of accidents altogether. They call such incidents crashes, and it is not something they are willing to tolerate at all. Samara Daly's life was changed forever because of a motorist's bad decision that nearly killed her husband.
My husband was run over by a truck while cycling to work, and the truck ran over his left leg and crushed it, leaving very little of his left lower leg left, which has resulted in about 10 reconstructive surgeries to save his leg and still ongoing treatment.
Samara is now a member of Families for Safer Streets, a New York City organization dedicated to curbing aggressive or reckless driving on the streets. They're a branch of Transportation Alternatives. Also with us is Carolyn Sampanaro, who's deputy director of Transportation Alternatives. The organization's mission is to reclaim New York City's streets from the automobile and to promote bicycling, walking, public transit. The first step in doing that?
Imagine waking up one morning thinking that it was going to be the same exact morning, and it ended up changing your life forever. You receive a call from the FDNY paramedic that your husband, in this case my husband, Lewis, was rushed in critical care to Bellevue Hospital to try and save his leg from amputation. Unfortunately, I never in a million years thought I was going to be that wife or that family. But indeed, it happened to our family in April of 2014. Nobody's invincible, unfortunately.
And I can hear the emotion in your voice, and it makes me think, even ask myself the question, why do we talk about people who get into traffic accidents with such a casual sense of, oh, well, traffic accident, well, that's too bad. Caroline, Families for Safer Streets, a 10th annual World Day of Remembrance for Road Traffic Victims. This idea of not using the word accident and using the word crash instead all seems to suggest that we as a nation, as a society, tolerate tens of thousands of deaths each year because of traffic crashes. Do you think that's the case?
I think that's exactly the case, John. 2.3 million Americans a year injured in traffic crashes. 2.3 million injuries is not an accident. It's a public health crisis, and it's something that we have control over. We know that great street design, better enforcement, better education can bring those numbers down. And we have the power to do that if our elected officials, our appointed officials, and as a society, we all chip in and we make changes.
I would agree. I mean, for me, hoping to get to a place where we don't have any more tragedies or awful, you know, crashes really needs to come to an end. And when you look at the number one incident for children under the age of 14 for injury-related deaths is to do with crashes, that's not tolerable. That's, you know, completely unacceptable and unimaginable as somebody who's raising, you know, a seven-year-old. And so I feel like people should become much more tolerant and much more outspoken about this issue.
Part of it is you have to imagine just how horrible it is to lose a seven-year-old child. But that's only one piece. The other piece is you have to believe, Caroline, that it's possible to design streets for commercial vehicles, public transit vehicles, and personal vehicles, and bicycles, and pedestrians, as opposed to just allow them to coexist without thinking about them. Can we design a system that works for all these, or is it kind of just chaos as it's been all my life?
We absolutely can. I mean, let's use the simple example of lowering the speed limit in New York City, which Transportation Alternatives and Families for Safe Streets did in 2014. When a driver is going 40 miles an hour and hits a pedestrian, 9 out of 10 times, someone will be killed. When that same driver is going 20 miles an hour on the same street, 9 out of 10 people walk away. So if we reinforce going slower with great street design, we literally have proven that we can save lives and prevent injuries. And so the difference between doing that and not doing that, of course, is in part a policy decision. But I think crash, not accident, really gets at the heart of what we can each do. We can each make a pledge to change the way we talk about this so that we put the right pressure on the decision makers that have the power to make change.
I love the speed limit, but how radical, Caroline, can we get with thinking about how to create more of a pecking order between commercial vehicles, public transit vehicles, personal vehicles, pedestrians, and bicyclists?
I mean, I think we have a long way to go. I think it's important to look at analogs, like you said. For example, let's think about drunk driving in this country. There used to be a time before Mothers Against Drunk Driving when drivers would hit and kill someone after getting drunk and getting in a car, and they'd say it was an accident, and they would drive away.
It was tolerated.
It was a private matter. And I think what we're talking about here is actually, again, the burdens on the system to protect people. And so, you know, in New York City right now, we're barely using automated enforcement, just as an example. Cities around the world are going out of their way to protect people by supplementing automated enforcement into the system. So failure to yield cameras, truck lane enforcement cameras, speed cameras, red light cameras. You know, if we were to scale up the way in which we deter dangerous driving, we'd be sending a stronger message to people driving in New York City and other cities around the country that, you know, people come first. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's a simple choice that a driver's making to press the gas pedal moving through an intersection with people walking, and that's a choice we can not have happen. It's a choice we can say as a city we won't tolerate. We can design the street better to make it so that that's less likely to cause harm. We can also make sure that drivers know that there are consequences for doing that.
Samara Daly and Caroline Sampanaro, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Here's something you don't hear on those viral videos in cases of alleged police misconduct: a voice responding to threats and accusations with calm. Are you going to shoot me, taunts an angry citizen? Listen.
What we need to do is communicate. What we need to do is talk. So let's get to the source of the problem. Let's have a conversation. Let's figure out what's going on.
That's Neil Griffin, a veteran police officer from San Diego, who reached out and wanted to show off his ability to mediate, show off his ability to calm things down, not ramp things up. He was anxious to join our conversation, motivated by communities trying to imagine their streets without any police. That's a conversation well underway in our Takeaway community. Brad from San Francisco wrote on thetakeaway.org, "I lived through the San Francisco police strike of 1975. The number of crimes committed by citizens decreased. The number of crimes committed by police increased." Here's Steve in Arkansas. "You try that and let me know how it works out. I find it hilarious. And if that community thinks police aren't working out, yeah, go ahead, stop that burglar yourself." Or Scott in New Jersey. "Obviously, a police force is necessary, but a police force comprised of ethical, law-abiding, honest, and prudent people, something sorely lacking." Neil Griffin would consider himself one of those law-abiding, honest, and prudent people. He's a police lieutenant in Southern California, has been in law enforcement for 26 years. He says he welcomes communities radically rethinking the role of police, but police, he says, need to be at the table. He told us that it's essential that he be heard, and that the voices of the vast majority of police, he says, who want to calm things down, be heard as well.
A lot of police officers are concerned with what is being projected to the public. But I think the issue is that it's being presented as business as usual in law enforcement. And it's just not the case. We contact somewhere between 40 and 60 million citizens a year, the police-citizen interactions. And very few of them involve force. The overwhelming majority of people who are contacted by the police, even under negative circumstances, come away thinking that the officers acted appropriately.
A lot of people were saying that this discussion of what do we need police for, could we get along without them, is there a way for us to responsibly police ourselves in our communities, led to a discussion and realization, which surprised me, but not too much, that police are, in our time, called out on incidents that they really have no expertise to deal with and shouldn't be called for. Mental health issues, a lot of the substance abuse issues should maybe be more in the social worker realm as opposed to the kinds of things that officers are called to try to mediate. Are you sympathetic to that? Do you think that's the case?
Well, I absolutely agree that police officers wind up as the first responders and getting called to situations where they're going to need other resources. That's kind of a tenet of law enforcement, is cops never get to say, I can't help you. Because the fact of the matter is, the police officer in this model of policing that we have is the first responder. And they're the person that are going to, you know, establish a certain level of peace. If it's a situation of some sort of confrontation, the expectation is that they're going to call on those sorts of resources, the social workers, the domestic violence counselors. Those are the people we immediately call. But somebody has to go first, John. Somebody has to walk the point, and somebody has to be that first responder. And when I think about things like ongoing domestic violence, when a woman picks up the phone and dials 911 because she needs a police officer right now or she needs emergency assistance, or when I think about the identification of pedophiles in a community, I'm just not sure how you can come up with a self-policing model for those sorts of situations. So yes, the police get called to a lot of situations where they need outside help, but the fact is somebody has to be there first, and that's usually us.
Now, you said somebody has to walk the point, and that's, you know, that's a military term.
It is.
And I'm wondering if sometimes that way of thinking gets in the way of community peace, and if it would help to have different kinds of first responders backing you up, who maybe would even be first in
interesting
a
idea.
Particularly a mental health situation.
And I'm not sure if you're familiar with the model that's used in quite a few places out here in California, is that we have a police officer who goes in service every day with a mental health professional, and they handle calls that are strictly about mental health issues. And they might be emergency calls for service from families, or they might be people that are just in need of some sort of mental health services. But we have a mental health professional. This is a model that was started in Los Angeles. It's called the Psychiatric Emergency Response Team. And it's spread quite a bit out here in California. It's a great model.
I want to question you about the idea that people view as typical the videos that are being seen in some of these racialized incidents. One of the things that's come out in the discussion of what the hell are we going to do about all this is this notion that people have to understand that for reasons that relate to American history, African Americans look at police in a different way than, say, I would look at police. And I'm just wondering if police need to think about that broad history that they may not be individually responsible for, but that they're coming into a community where the image that they might have of themselves or that I would have is very, very different, and that we need to recognize our history a little bit better to be better first responders, all of us. Does that make any sense?
I agree. No, it absolutely makes sense, and I agree with you. And over the years, I've taught at different police academies, and one of the things I always like to get those young police officers to think about is what it felt like when the police came through their neighborhoods. And, you know, most police that we end up recruiting will talk about the positive interactions. But more and more, as we recruit a more and more diverse population, there are people who grew up in neighborhoods where they're very articulate about the fact that the police weren't seen in a positive light. And that's just the reality, as you said. That's the history. That's the hand we've been dealt. And we have to acknowledge that. And again, removing the anonymous nature of law enforcement, just the patrol car going by with the windows up and not stopping. Community policing is all about trying to bridge that gap. But yeah, the police are doing their best to deal with it, but we recognize it. And I think nothing is more, I don't know what the word I would want to use, but it's very hurtful when you know someone is afraid of the police. And candidly, I think the abolishment of the police, I don't think that's a realistic option. But what is a realistic option? You want to have the meeting, you want to pose the question, you want to question the assumption I think that's great. The police need to be involved in that conversation, the police that are involved in that community. That gap that exists now between communities and the police, that's what we have to work on.
Neil Griffin, a police lieutenant in Southern California, the 26-year veteran, just wants to be at the table. The great state of Texas is warm and in general dry, but a network of streams is etched into the dusty soil of this state, which means when the rains come, stream beds fill quickly and flood often. Here in Austin, we're not too far from a part of Central Texas known as Flash Flood Alley, with emphasis on the word flash, says nearby city administrator Don Ferguson from the town of Wimberley.
There's really not any advance information tool in place to give us an idea of what's coming. So we rely in large part on Weather Service forecasts, but more importantly, we rely on what we kind of call the old timers network, and that is we have a number of folks upstream that they keep a close eye, and they're good neighbors, and they pick up the phone and call us when they get extremely heavy rainfall events.
And one of those occurred earlier this year when a surprise flash flood destroyed 300 homes and killed 12 people in Wimberley. Researchers at the University of Texas Austin are looking to replace an archaic flood prediction system with new computers that can forecast floods up to 15 hours before they hit. Joining me to discuss the system is Mose Bushell, reporter for State Impact Texas at KUT. Mose, welcome.
Thank you.
And the old timers network, it sounds pretty reliable, but not fast. And these computers would take similar information to what the old timers have, but also extrapolate out to what's happening.
That's right. What they're planning on doing is taking advances in predicting rainfall, understanding the geography better, and feeding all that through these supercomputers so that they can have a clear sense of where and when it might flood.
And do they have to watch the entire state and the entire weather picture to do that?
This is actually part of a national plan. So they'll be looking all across the country at different kind of defining things down to the creek bed, where you might see heavy rainfall and then how that flow in that creek would intersect with a river and could potentially damage a city, you know, miles and miles away.
How do you notify people quickly? Is it radio? Is it cell phones? Is it, a variety of platforms, I would think.
Yeah,
I
mean, often, as the city administrator alluded to, they pay attention to the National Weather Service. So, you know, those folks are in touch with emergency responders. And then when you're trying to evacuate people, you can do things like reverse 911. Often they end up needing to go door to door, you know, really taking people out of their houses.
Is this designed custom for flood emergencies, or does it rely on other kinds of weather notification systems, other kinds of algorithms that take a look at the atmosphere and predict what's going to happen on the ground?
So my understanding is this is designed specifically for floods, and the kind of long-term goal is to create a system where, you know, how we have a tornado warning system nationally. So this is something where they could look and say, you're likely to have a flood even 15 hours out, looking at weather forecasts.
In terms of broad climate change issues, are these anticipated to be much more frequent?
So we've had three major floods in this area in the last 2 years. A lot of scientists say that we can expect these extreme weather events to happen more and more frequently with climate change.
Changing development patterns. People shouldn't live in the floodplain. Living in a place called Floodplain Alley maybe isn't the best idea in the world.
Another huge debate that's happening here right now. I mean, Texas is a rapidly growing state. The last year we've had wildfires and flooding.
And drought.
And drought and catastrophic flooding. So where you develop is an important question. And critics do say that we need to be more careful about where we're allowing building to take place.
Mose Bushell talking about the new flood warning network, which will be in place when?
They're going to go live with that next May at the new National Water Center.
Just in time for the flood season next year. Mose Bushell, State Impact Texas reporter for KUT. Thanks so much, Mose.
Thanks, Hawk.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like genetics, graphic design, and golf. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI. The Henry Luce Foundation. For increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
Hope you have a great weekend. And one of the features of the waning but enduring tradition of the thick Sunday paper on the weekends is that colorful section, you know.
Sammy, what's wrong?
I'm reading the funny papers.
Oh, of course. Jimmy's reading the funny papers.
The funny papers. Obsessive joy for readers.
Marmaduke.
You have to make a comic every day if you're a comics artist. They can't all be winners, especially if you're doing 365 a year. So it's more that they're a constant presence. You know, when they're part of your rhythm of how you consume media, they worm their way into your head.
Josh Frühlinger runs a blog called The Comics Curmudgeon. Growing up, he says the comic section was the first thing he would read every day. And because he was a bit of a completist, he would read every single comic, even the ones he didn't like or didn't get. Well, if you're still a loyal subscriber of the print edition of your local newspaper this Sunday, don't expect Josh to answer the phone before noon. Hundreds of newspapers are celebrating the 100th anniversary of comics giant King Features Syndicate with a special 16-page color insert of those classic newspaper comic strips. Dennis the Menace will be back. Blondie, Hagar the Horrible, Sherman's Lagoon, Rex Morgan, M.D., Mutz, Zitz. This weekend, they make a dramatic return to the pages. Comics are back in pop culture, even if newspapers are out. Graphic novels sell almost as well as straight prose, but Sunday comics are solid nostalgia. Frühlinger says he'd have to fight with his mom for the funnies back in the day.
She remembered when she was a kid, you know, she grew up in Ohio, and she would visit her grandparents who lived in Oklahoma, and they had a different newspaper there and different comics, and she would read all the comics in that paper, too. And I definitely remember doing that as a kid. We would go to different cities, and if there was a newspaper, I'd read them all.
Comics and the want ads were the most essential parts of the cash value of the old daily newspaper. And for a while, there was a mini boom in comics and want ads. Josh loved that.
Maybe in like the 80s and 90s, in the sense that, you know, a lot of places that used to be two newspaper cities, you know, with media consolidation in that era, the newspapers would combine. And at one point, comics were the sort of differentiating thing. It's like I grew up in Buffalo, and there were some comics that ran in the Courier Express, and there were some that ran in the Buffalo News. And that was a way that they tried to woo people from one to the other. But when they merged, all the comics were together, and all of a sudden you had these really huge comics pages for a brief period. And I think we all know the story of newspapers hemorrhaging money over the last couple decades.
But as comic sections shrank, artists took their craft onto the internet directly using new digital rendering tools.
There's a huge and very diverse and very interesting and very dynamic web comics community that is the modern equivalent of the newspaper comic section. The flip side of it is that, you know, the comics used to be kind of universal in the sense that there were only a few hundred of them, and there were ones that were very popular, were read by everyone all across the country. Now there are thousands of web comics. There's more diversity, there's more choice that you have, but fewer of them that are sort of cultural mainstays, I think.
As technology always does, YouTube and Photoshop have enabled a vast, jumbled, searchable library of comics, like Burke Breathed's Bloom County, which left the newspapers in 1989 and now is enjoyed by downloading fans. Bloom County was a bit of a cult classic. But Peanuts and Calvin and Hobbes, which have found their lives in the movies, and even their less successful peers, The Far Side by Gary Larson, for instance, and others, they're like oddball family members.
There are strips like The Family Circus or Hi and Lois that are kind of like your grandparents or your great-grandparents in that they've been there forever. It used to be great. They're a little faded now. Sometimes it's really hard to get them culturally. I think Beetle Bailey is definitely like your drunk great uncle. Garfield is a sassy 9-year-old. I think Garfield is a great strip for teaching children about sarcasm. It's a machine designed to delight slightly precocious children.
Me? I love the Neanderthal Antics of BC by Johnny Hart. But we want to hear from you. Which comic strips do you love and why? Do you follow the satire of Doonesbury or the soapy narrative of Prince Valiant? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave us a comment on the 16-page spread that will appear in your Sunday paper. You can see some of the comics that will be featured in this weekend's spread at thetakeaway.org.
I want you to get up now.
Great story. Compelling and rich.
I want all of you to get up out of your chairs.
You're going
to
hype it with the facts.
And go to the window.
What? We only have 10 minutes left. How can you talk to me about parking problems?
And stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. Kristen Meinzer is out this week, and to talk about movies on Friday the 13th, we've got Movie Date podcast co-host Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Welcome, Rafer.
Hi, John.
Let's start with the first movie, Spotlight, which takes on a very, very challenging subject. Here's a clip.
This is Boston, and the church does not want them to be found. So, they are not there.
Mitch, are you telling me that the Catholic Church removed legal documents from that courthouse?
Look, I'm not crazy. I'm not paranoid. I'm experienced. Check the docket. You'll see. They control everything.
Fast on the heels of Black Mass about the mafia in Boston, this is all about the Catholic Church sex abuse scandal. How does it work for you?
Well, it works pretty well, I think. And I think this movie is going to be one of, if not the big Oscar contender for this year. That was Mark Ruffalo playing one of the Boston Globe reporters who broke this story. What's great about this story is it reminds me a lot of All the President's Men. It's a procedural. It's not really a character-driven story, even though you've got this amazing cast, Rachel McAdams, Michael Keaton playing a newspaper editor again after the paper, John Slattery, Stanley Tucci there in that clip. Great cast, but the story is more important, the digging, going back to the docket, the court records, the old dusty diocese directories to find these priests and what they've done and how the Catholic Church shuffled them around. It's a pretty amazing story. And it's a very heroic work of journalism, as we all now know.
More real life in the movie 33. Everyone remembers the trapped miners who were trapped in South America for 33 miners who were trapped in South America. Here is a clip from this movie starring Antonio Banderas.
They'll wait 3 days. They close the mine and put up the gravestones.
No. 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 No! I don't believe that. They'll dig us out. And if they don't, our families will. With their bare hands if it's necessary. I believe we'll make it out of here because I choose to believe it. All 33 of us.
They bonded together. It was something that held the entire nation of Chile in a spell and the entire world watched. How does it work as a movie?
Well, I think this movie's got, again, a very good cast. Banderas there playing Mario. He's sort of the de facto leader of the miners. The press began to call him Super Mario because he was such a great organizer and a great leader. And it's nice to see Lou Diamond Phillips back after, you know, who knows how many years. He plays well, the safety engineer who's also trapped down there with them. I do think this movie's got a couple of problems. One is we all remember this story, as you said, and it wasn't that long ago, and it was a real miraculous survival story. So we all kind of know how it ends. And two, 33 characters, you know, you can't really, you know, cover everyone in a movie with 33 characters in 2 hours. So they do a lot of fictionalizing, a lot of compositing of characters. And I don't think it works that well. There's a, you know, young dad who's got a child on the way. He's sort of a fictional character. There's an alcoholic character who's going to go through withdrawal. And some of these things seem to kind of tidy up the story to me. I would have been more interested to find out what happened to the miners afterwards. Because, excuse me, a lot of those guys had real problems readjusting. The fame got to them. A lot of them went back into the mines. A lot of them had to scrape to get by financially. That sort of untold story would have been more compelling to me.
And it doesn't take you into the mine like Das Boot took you into a submarine. You don't get that sense of being confined.
No, I will say it does a pretty good job of that visually, especially at the beginning. The actual collapse of the mine is pretty spectacular, and it does give you that sense of all these layers that they are under in the earth that collapse on top of them and this giant rock that blocks their passage out. That's all pretty magnificent, but I think once the movie becomes kind of a waiting game and you're waiting for them to be rescued, it loses a little bit of its tension.
Let's get to the exciting film for this week, really. I think Suffragette is going to turn a lot of heads and remind people of some really important history about when women got the vote. Listen.
If we got the vote...
What would you do with it, Maud?
Do the same you do yours, honey. Exercise my rights.
Exercise your rights? You're a suffragette now? One of those panks?
No.
Mrs. Miller is. You know how they like to talk? You spend your time with her, that's what they'll call you.
What do you think?
I wish I liked this movie a little bit more. Really? It's got such a great concept, the idea that these women were kind of forced to become something like terrorists, blowing up post office boxes, blowing up houses, turning to violence, shattering storefront windows to get attention and get the right to vote. That's a pretty interesting topic. But I think the film treats it very tidily. Maude Watts, played by Carey Mulligan, again, a fictional character dropped into a real situation, doesn't quite work. And the ending, even though it's based in fact, left me scratching my head. I don't want to spoil too much, but I didn't quite understand what happened at the film's ending, and I thought that was kind of a problem.
These women who are behind this film are very passionate about the subject. Does that get in the way?
No, I don't think so. I think you can tell that their heart is in the right place and they really want to, you know, make this statement. The film has a closing crawl at the end of it where it lists all the different countries in the world that have given women the right to vote. And it's some of them gave that right shockingly late. And that actually makes a better point, I think, than the film that came before it. But it's interesting to see, you know, Saudi Arabia, they still can't vote.
Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer will be back together in the podcast. He's a film critic for Newsday and co-host of the Movie Date podcast. Thanks so much, Rafer.
Thanks a lot, John.
What would make you cross the line to radically confront authorities, to demand your rights?
Women do not have the calmness of temperament or the balance of mind to exercise judgment in political affairs.
The new film chronicles the pioneers who helped encourage the beginnings of the women's suffrage movement, a group of British women who were ready to die for that right, the right to vote, which they finally won in 1918. People need to be reminded that women in France had to wait until 1944. Women in Switzerland fought for their right to vote, granted only in 1971, and it was 1920 when women in the U.S. got the vote. This film about the brave British pioneers is called Suffragette, starring Carey Mulligan, Helena Bonham Carter, and Meryl Streep as suffragette leader Emmeline Pankhurst. Sarah Gavron directed the film and talked about it with Emmeline Pankhurst's great-granddaughter, Dr. Helen Pankhurst. She says that her grandmother's radical activism didn't happen all at once back in the late 1800s. It was a slow build, she says, of frustrations and delays that led her to the militant suffragist cause.
It's important to see it as a gradual ratcheting up, both by the women themselves and by government. It isn't like a single act by them. It's following years and years and years, and I can't repeat it enough, and years of broken promises. So then what you have is them, the women, trying to get a voice, trying to find a way of being heard, and the government increasingly stopping them from using any legal mechanism of being heard. And then gradually, the whole thing becomes more and more vicious on both, well, more vicious on the government side, more willing to take anything and to keep pushing the boundaries on the women's side. And I think there is a fundamental difference between the extremism and the kind of violence that we hear about today and what they were doing, which was that they were very, very clear that there wasn't going to be any violence done to people other than the one that was done to them continuously. So clear blue water for me between their kind of radicalism and the type of things that we see in the world today.
Well, let's listen to the haunting voice, haunting to you, Helen, certainly, of Emmeline Pankhurst in the film Suffragette.
We are fighting for a time in which every little girl born into the world will have an equal chance with her brothers. Never underestimate the power we women have to define our own destinies. We do not want to be lawbreakers. We want to be lawmakers.
Helen, how did she do in evoking that time and that sense of your family?
Yeah, I think she was fantastic. I mean, Emmeline was an icon, remains an icon. And here's Meryl, the iconic actor, if ever there was one, and such a strong feminist, such a strong person in her own right playing this role. The two fuse together beautifully.
Sarah, I followed the film, the trailers, and the live panel discussions that you all have had, and have seen the sense and experienced the sense of enthusiasm that all of you have about this project. How does that translate into telling a story you're really telling a story that has not been told in the big screen in this kind of treatment.
Yes, that's right. That's why we were so keen to bring it to the big screen, because it seemed it was a huge social movement. It made a huge impact on our history, and it seemed time to tell this story. We were very aware that we wanted to make it a good piece of cinema and a good watch, and we felt the way to do that was to connect the audience emotionally and tell a human story and one that people could relate to. So by centering it around a small group of women with Maud Watts, played by Carey Mulligan, at the centre, we followed her journey, and we felt that would be a way that would make it accessible.
Some of the male characters in this film come off as quite monstrous in their sense of ownership of women and women's bodies and that sort of thing. But you also have this sense, and I think it's much more nuanced, of men viewing, oh, for heaven's sakes, you want to vote. How silly. And on the other side, the women see this as absolutely revolutionary. That contrast is quite remarkable, and it really sort of speaks to the different points of view here and how this had to be a radical revolution. Helen?
You know, you have to live the life of subservience to understand there comes a point where people will say enough is enough. In any social movement, in any change historically, people will accept the daily grind, the daily injustice, and then there comes a point where they say no. And that point isn't the point at which most of the oppressors will understand and accept at that moment. So you do have to have this shifting of social norms and of individual people's perspectives. And that's what this film shows.
In the feminist movement in the United States and around the world, often a radicalism as a feminist is viewed by men as some sort of ambiguity regarding sexuality. Was that how radicalism was treated in Britain? It's quite subtle, as you've treated it here in the film, but it's nonetheless there. Sarah?
Yeah, I think that they suffered a lot and they were satire and they were ridiculed by the press. And there are some amazing cartoons and postcards that were released showing sort of grotesque looking women and, you know, the horrors of women who wanted to be emancipated and how crossing the line that was. I mean, I think what was really striking was how they were shamed, particularly the working class women who we were focusing on, you know, the shame in the community when you stepped out and spoke out, you know, that Edwardian society was all about respectability. So it makes what they did all the more remarkable, I think. Today, I'm heartened. I mean, I know that we've got a long way to go and that we have to keep fighting. But one thing that's happening and has happened kind of around this film is that there seems to be a re-engagement with using the word feminist and it being positive and it being appropriated by men and women. And, you know, it speaks to wanting equality, which we know is good for everybody.
What do you want a young girl, a digital native teenage girl who can't probably even imagine the idea of women in the West not voting? What do you want them to get out of this film, Sarah?
Well, I want them to realize how hard fought for these rights are and how recently they were won and how precious they are and how important it is to stand up and be counted and how I hope that they are empowered, if that's the right word, to speak out and challenge current inequalities. And in the States particularly, it'd be great if it encouraged people to use their vote. In the UK, we've got a dwindling population of voters amongst the young and particularly young women. And it really struck me making this film that you know, when the women got the vote in 1918 partially and in 1928 fully, there was a slew of legislation that began to change their lives. It didn't go far enough, but it significantly changed their lives. And now our government doesn't care about young people because they don't go out and vote. So it's critically important to use that vote, and it's critically important to challenge inequality.
Sarah Gavron, Dr. Helen Pankhurst, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sarah Gavron is the director of Suffragette, and Dr. Helen Pankhurst is the great granddaughter of Emmeline Pankhurst, the British suffragette leader, portrayed by Meryl Streep in the film. And here's something to take with you today. I want you to reach out and comfort, if you can, one of the more than 20 million Frigatris cadecaphobes. Look at the calendar. Those people have difficulty on every Friday the 13th. They fear the number 13, but only on Friday. Here's a famous sufferer, Franklin D. Roosevelt, the man who said
that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
He refused to travel on Friday the 13th. He really avoided the day. He died on Thursday, April 12th, 1945. So I'm flying back to New York today? Are you serious? Driving to Dallas on Friday the 13th and then getting on an airplane? Come on. Stay lucky, folks. From the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas, this is The Takeaway.
Really? We're getting on a plane? Friday the 13th?
PRI, Public Radio International.